Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the April 16th reading of the environment. My name is John. Today I plan to share at least the following two articles. We'll lead off with Mother Earth News and How to Work, Self-Reliant Skills. Completing that, we'll roll over to the Nature Earth magazine of the Sierra Club and share the article, The History They Fear is the Truth We Carry. And back to Mother Earth News, our first article, How to Work, Self-Reliant Skills, written by Steve Maxwell. The story opens up with a picture of a beautiful stone and timber home, like in any fancy suburb, out in the middle of basically nowhere, just a beautiful, beautiful home. It's captioned, "The author's family hand-built this handsome stone and timber home on their rural Ontario acreage. Knowing how to work, as well as having house-building know-how, was integral to completing the construction process. Put into practice these six habits to master these truly make-or-break homesteading self-reliant skills, how to work properly." In October 1986, I cut through a tumble-down wire fence and drove my old pickup truck onto the rural property I'd just bought with my life savings. I was a 23-year-old dreamer back then, with a desire to live in the country by the labor of my own hands. I'm now living that dream and thriving on that same property along with my wife Mary and our five kids. We built our own house, and we enjoy food, fuel, and beauty from our land. We're now blessed to see a second generation setting up a homestead of their own and putting their self-reliance skills to use on our family acreage. Now we have a picture. It's a picture of a very large garden shed, maybe one of those tiny homes, and it's captioned, "Steve and Mary Maxwell started out small in 1986 as self-reliant dreamers, but they had big goals." The article continues, "Few other dreamers I've known have managed to fulfill their ambitions. In my experience, most dreams do not die because of a lack of practical homesteading skills or passion, but rather become casualties of the failure of knowing to work efficiently to get enough of the right kind of work done. Bills pile up, gardens do not get planted, roofs continue to leak, enthusiasm wanes. The cause of these problems often goes unrecognized until passion is cold, relationships frazzled, and finances exhausted. Knowing how to work efficiently on a homestead where you are your own boss requires a specific skill set that contrasts sharply with the skills needed to work a traditional office job. I've worked for wages, and now I work from home on my own land, and the two experiences are entirely different. If your goal is to be in charge of your own successful modern homestead, you must learn how to work, which is just as important as learning practical skills. Put into practice the following six homesteading habits to help you get the right work done in the right way, and you'll bring the satisfaction of self-reliant living one big step closer. 1. Learning how to work. Set guiding principles. A homesteader without goals is like a ship without a rudder. You may be sailing, but you won't end up where you want to go. You need to decide at the outset what kind of lifestyle you want. For us, it came down to three main guiding principles. Earn all family income without leaving the property, raise our kids with us at home, and provide for as many of our basic needs as possible from our own land and labor. Next is a picture of the new stone and timber household in mid-construction along with the beginning of an orchard. The photograph is captioned, "Set long-term housestead goals. It takes several years for a young orchard to bear fruit." Back to the article. Determine your own principles and let them be the rudder that guides your voyage towards self-sufficiency. Use them to set long-term goals, broken down by year and month. Being specific will help you figure out what you need to accomplish each day in order to achieve those goals and live in line with your principles. Number two, learning how to work. Follow a disciplined schedule with rest. No boss, no outside schedules, no imposed deadlines. These are some of the attractions of working from home, but they're also likely to contribute to failure. Not having a boss means your success will depend almost entirely on how well you determine what must get done. When setting your own schedule without imposed deadlines, you'll thrive only if you fill your day with productive activities. Self-reliant living is really about responsibility. So why bother with self-reliance if it doesn't get you out of work? The satisfaction of gaining directly from your own efforts is one reason. This connection between productivity and benefit is one of the things I like most about my modern homestead. Plus, completing many of the wide variety of homestead tasks alongside family and friends makes work more like serious play. Day-to-day living on a successful modern homestead starts with a schedule that includes 8 hours of constructive work each day. You'll probably want to work longer because your work will be fulfilling. But all work and no play is not sustainable either. The older I get, the more I value setting aside a day of rest. We work hard for 6 days and then relax and enjoy the fruits of our labors on the seventh day. Number three, learning how to work. Do the right work. Today, we have easy, unprecedented access via the internet to the information needed to create a thriving homestead lifestyle. You can pick up almost any self-reliance skill imaginable, learn how to work from home, and establish international connections with like-minded folks online, which makes the internet an invaluable tool for the modern homesteader. You'll need many more tools, of course, but the internet is crucial. I'm sure our homestead life would never have succeeded without it. All that said, even essential how-to information is wasted if it's not applied to the tasks that matter most. That's why you must prioritize where you invest your efforts. The best way to do so, I've found, is to make and use lists. In the evening, write down everything that needs doing the next day based on your predetermined goals for the following week and month. At this point, we have a photo of a little red shed with 10 or 15 white chickens bobbing around in front of it, a small little fenced-in pasture with a mother pig, a sow, and the baby piglets, along with one of the owners petting them. It's captioned, "Homesteading skills range from knowing how to raise livestock, such as these guinea hogs, to knowing when to relax and enjoy the company of your homestead's critters." Story continues. Do not let personal preference for certain jobs delay you from tackling what you know should be high priority items, and do not worry about items on the list you aren't getting to yet. Just be sure you get to them later, after you've handled the immediate to-dos. Number four, learning how to work. Work the right way. Having the proper tools to work efficiently will make a huge difference. Doing work in the right way means equipping yourself the way a professional would, not as a hobbyist would. You probably won't be able to buy professional-grade tools and gear right away, but work towards it. Here's a photograph of a young man bent over working on the engine of a red tractor, brilliant blue sky, a tree in the background. The picture is captioned, "Robert Maxwell learned from his father, Steve, that one of the keys to homestead success is having the right equipment and the right tools." Here, he applies that knowledge to finish up some maintenance work on the family's Farmall Super H tractor. Story continues. You can also buy or rent equipment to share with a group. Hire your neighbor who owns a tractor to till your garden. Barter labor for a side of beef. Or trade work for the opportunity to borrow a wood splitter until you can build your own collection of equipment. Aim to become not a jack of all trades, but a well-equipped master of most self-reliant skills. It's a long-term goal that will set you up for lasting prosperity. Number five, learning how to work. carry a notepad. Pound for pound, my notepad and pen are the most valuable physical tools I own. They're always with me to catch the little thoughts that waft through my head throughout the day. Buy 5 pounds of 4-inch deck screws. Call Rob about shingle order. Take photo of spiders in pasture for blog. Harvest garlic. This habit prevents me from letting tasks that need doing escape my memory, neglecting details, and wasting trips to town by forgetting to buy all the items I need. Here's a picture of Steve, the owner and the author, outside of the home, and it clearly shows a couple of pens and his notebook right there in his front chest pocket. Captioned, "Even when pausing during the day, the author keeps his handy pen and notepad at the ready so he can keep track of any details that come up and mark off his to-do list." Whether you use a smartphone, tablet, or simple paper pad, as I do, recording crucial details that come up during each workday will be vital because it will ultimately boost efficiency. And number 6, learning how to work. Work efficiently and avoid distractions. An old-timer I know tells a story of how things used to be in the countryside where he grew up during the 1930s. We were dirt poor, but everyone managed to keep their barns repaired and houses painted. Nowadays, people sit inside watching satellite TV or YouTube while their places fall apart around their ears. The most spectacular homesteading failures I've seen all involve people who talk a lot and move slowly. While the internet is an essential homesteading tool, it's also full of distractions that turn people into spectators and consumers rather than participants and producers. No responsible boss would allow you to watch television, play games, or socialize online while you're on the clock. What you might not realize is that when working from home, your homestead can actually fire you. When your garden does not get tilled in time and your woodpile is too small come November, the homestead will hand you a pink slip, and it will be at least as shocking as the regular kind. You're free to indulge in these distractions during the workday, but they could cost you your dreams of a self-reliant, hands-on life, and they probably will. Scroll up to the next picture. It's a picture of the author walking away from the camera, towing a large wheelbarrow full of, it looks like raked leaves or perhaps some mulch. Caption tells us, "To work from home successfully, you have to be able to be your own boss and keep regular, constructive working hours. The varied nature of homestead skills and tasks will make your work fulfilling and more like serious play than hard labor, even when you're hauling mulch to your garden beds." Article continues, "Simply moving quickly as you walk around and perform tasks can significantly add to your productivity. Don't run about frantically, but rather work efficiently and be deliberate and focused. After picking up the pace becomes a habit, productive work will become the new normal, and you'll thrive." Learning the practical nuts and bolts of hands-on living is vital and just as imperative as mastering the 6 homesteading habits detailed here, which will keep you working efficiently and effectively. In my experience, how you work will be the most critical part of making your dreams of successful, self-reliant living your reality. A day in the life. My day starts at about 7 a.m. when I either work on digital projects or hands-on jobs such as fixing machinery, tending cattle and fences, or working in the garden. My wife, Mary, is a full-time homemaker. She has lunch ready for the family at noon, and then I go back to work until 6 p.m. Lately, I've spent my afternoons cutting and splitting firewood and helping my son build his own house for him and his wife. The kids handle cleaning up after supper, so Mary and I are free to walk with our dog along a forest trail for a couple of miles. It's quite a treat to hear whippoorwills sing while a full moon rises through the trees. As I write this article, my to-do list includes putting the garden to bed, completing a promotional video and website for a local marina, helping one of my sons finish a simple, portable chicken coop he's been building, picking some apples for Mary to use for a pie bee that she's participating in with friends of hers, extending the watering system on our cattle pasture, and working on my websites with my digital assistants, Mike and Christina, who live 400 miles away. This is a general pattern of our day-to-day work for 6 days a week. We don't work beyond the essential chores on Sundays. The variety of a homestead work week makes it so much nicer than hourly paid work, at least for me. I look forward to Mondays just as much as I do Fridays, and I'm excited to get out of bed each day. Our carbon footprint is smaller than it would be otherwise because we don't travel for work. We heat with wood, and we make, reuse, and repair a lot of what we need. This is not the life for everyone, but it certainly is for us. The next included picture is a picture of Steve with his son, and together they're learning how to use the wood lathe. It's captioned, "Steve shows his son Jake how to properly use a lathe in his on-farm workshop." Making ends meet, earn money at home. When my wife and I began in the mid-1980s, our plan was to work from home by building furniture and running a pick-your-own berry farm. That began to change when my interest in writing led to my first published article in 1988. Today, I earn most of my income from creating articles, blog posts, and videos about woodworking, construction, and power tools. I do business from the shop and studio I built on our property. We still grow berries and work with wood, but it's usually for our own use, with cash coming in mostly from digital projects. What will you do to make ends meet on your homestead? Whatever it is, make it an extension of your interests and aptitudes, and include the internet as part of the mix. The internet can enhance any business, and few rural areas have the population to support small businesses that don't also have a digital outlet. This next photograph is bright colored, shows a young curly-haired blonde kid sitting on a nice green lawn with some red potted geraniums behind him and baskets of fresh raspberries in front of him. It's captioned, "Joseph Maxwell shows off a bountiful raspberry harvest from when the family sold berries commercially. Now the berries are kept for the family's own consumption, and the author earns most of his income from digital sources." Story continues. Farmer friends of mine are using the internet to market their high-quality beef to urban markets. A young mother I know makes exquisite chocolates in the commercial-grade kitchen she set up in her country home and then sells her confections online to consumers across the continent. Living in a remote geographic location often creates a big challenge for rural homesteaders trying to earn money at home, and the internet helps remove that barrier. Note on the author, Steve Maxwell is a self-dubbed backwoods peasant who connects digitally with a worldwide audience to share his homesteading and DIY expertise. He lives with his family on Manitoulin Island in Ontario, Canada. Our next article today comes from the Magazine of the Sierra Club and is titled, "The History They Fear is the Truth We Carry. We Cannot Rely on Oral Tradition Alone." Written by Ben Jealous. The last living link of my family's story of origin in antebellum South Virginia died at age 105 just a few years ago. My grandmother, Mamie Todd, was born in 1916. Her grandparents were born into slavery. She fought Jim Crow. She stood up for black teachers and students in a segregated school system in which she taught in her early career. She supported my mom when, at 12, she signed on as a named plaintiff in one of the feeder cases to Brown v. Board of Education. And she stood by my mom every step of the way when 3 years after that, my mom helped desegregate her high school. That's the kind of strength I come from. That's the kind of history it seems the Trump administration now wants to erase. The Washington Post and other outlets are reporting that the Trump administration's scorched earth campaign to purge diversity, equity, and inclusion from every corner of our federal government has now spread into the heart of the National Park Service. Web pages about slavery and the Underground Railroad have been edited to downplay the brutal reality of bondage and the contributions of black leaders. The photo of Harriet Tubman that for years greeted visitors to an NPS stage about the Underground Railroad has been deleted. A web page about the Niagara Movement, a precursor to the NAACP founded in 1905 by W.E.B. Du Bois, was rewritten. a statement written about the group's renewed sense of resolve in the struggle for freedom and equality was shortened simply to a renewed sense of resolve. And we have a photograph. It's a close-up of a bronze statue in a yellow-walled room, very simple background, and it's captioned, "A statue of abolitionist Harriet Tubman at the Maryland State House in Annapolis." The story continues, "Heroic Americans gave their lives fighting for freedom and equality. Now the Trump administration is trying to edit those very words out of the official American story. Some say these changes are minor. I say they are surgical. They are subtle, yes, but profoundly damaging. As one historian put it, these edits suggest that racism no longer needs to be confronted in America. And that's the point. This is not about saving space on a government website. It is about shrinking the story of who we are as a people. Some Park Service employees who edited the websites say they made the changes out of fear. Others were simply guessing what the administration wanted. When workers are deleting key figures and events in Black history without being told, just to stay safe in their jobs, we are in dangerous territory. We've seen this before. Last month, we learned that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's DEI purge at the Pentagon included deleting photos and posts about the Tuskegee Airmen. That hit home. Two of my grandfather's first cousins were Tuskegee Airmen. Those men risked everything for a country that treated them as second-class citizens, and now this administration is reluctant to give them even a photo or a caption? They even removed a webpage about Jackie Robinson's military service. They later said it was a mistake, but when you see how wide this purge has spread, it starts to look less like a mistake and more like a mission. A recent executive order from President Trump set its sights on the Smithsonian. He is targeting the very museums created to tell the full story of our country. What does this mean for the very existence of the National Museum of African American History and Culture, or the National Museum of the American Indian? What happens to truth when it is inconvenient to power? We cannot rely on oral tradition alone. Our history deserves permanence. It deserves pages and plaques and national monuments and memorials. It deserves official recognition, not redaction. I think of my family's own story, the parts that were buried for generations. I'm descended from the main Black leader of the Readjusters, a multiracial political movement that briefly but very successfully governed post-Reconstruction Virginia. They were left out of the history books for more than a century, not because they were not important, but because they were. History is power, and that's why they are going after it. The Trump administration's attacks are not about race-blind policy. They are about race-based erasure. They support monuments to those who fought to preserve slavery while censoring stories of resistance. That's not color blindness. That's complicity. It should not have to keep being said over and over again, but we will not let them diminish our community's contributions or deny our place in the American story. We are still here, and like the men and women of the Niagara Movement, we renew our sense of resolve. Our resolve is real, and it is rising. We've got just a couple minutes left, and we'll look real quickly at this day in history. On April 16th in 1908, Natural Bridges National Monument was formally established in southeastern Utah. In 1917, Vladimir Lenin ended a 17-year exile and returned to Russia to form a provisional government. On this date in 1943, Swiss chemist Albert Hofmann discovered the psychedelic properties of LSD, a drug he had first synthesized in 1938. On April 16th in 1947, American basketball player Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who won 5 NBA championships with the Los Angeles Lakers, was born. In 1947, 62, American journalist Walter Cronkite became anchor of the CBS Evening News, a position he held for nearly two decades, during which time he became known as the most trusted man in America. Also on this date in 2003, at age 40, Michael Jordan, widely regarded as the best player in the history of basketball, played his last game in the National Basketball Association. In 2014, the South Korean ferry Sual traveled from Incheon to Jeju, capsized and sank, killing 304 people, most of whom were high schoolers. And finally, on April 16th in 1912, American aviator Harriet Quimby became the first woman to fly across the English Channel, guiding her French Blériot monoplane through heavy, overcast skies from Dover, England to Hardelot, France. That does take up the time we have today. Thanks so much for joining us for the April 16th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.